2021 at 1:30 p.m. We're assembled via Zoom at the courthouse for legal counsel update. Item number one has got a pretty long agenda today, so let's get right at it. Item number one is proposed resolution number 2021-031 in the matter of employment requirements for qualified business firms in the Rogue Enterprise Zone. Wally, you're up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fowler.
Always.
Yes, so this is something we have talked about on a prior occasion. The Enterprise Zone designation was assigned to Playcraft Systems, LLC, which is a Josephine County business. And then because of the circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, that company was not able to, for that period of time, fulfill its requirements of increased payroll. So we have received a letter from Playcraft. It's attached to the resolution. It's in your packet. And we predict that they will be able to satisfy, time has moved on since the pandemic circumstance to held them back. They do predict that they'll be able to satisfy the requirements. And so because the legislature enacted House Bill 2343 in this most recent session, the board has an option of passing this resolution and allowing Playcraft to continue with its enterprise zone designation for the years of 2021 to 2022 tax year. Or for the 2022-23 tax year, which is the both of which are mentioned here in the resolution. Resolution finally was based largely on one that we received from Business of Oregon State Agency, and so we are presenting this to the board here today for your consideration, and then you advance it to a business session if you so choose. And I see that the assessor and Mr. Parton looks like they're here as well, and so I don't know if they have further additions, but that's pretty much my piece of it.
Along, usually these enterprise zones and so on and so forth for a given period of time, like the first 5 years of your business or something, or you apply for enterprise status, which I guess forgives you your property tax for a given period of time. What is the time on this one?
It is 1 year. Connie, could you give us the definitive answer on that?
Yes. The enterprise zone that they get pre-approved for these before they even start to do the work to expand. And in that pre-approval, it was for a 3-year exemption. That would be the length of time that they would get. Is 3 years of a property tax exemption, and then it goes away after that.
Okay, I'm going to see here for 2021-22, 2022-23 taxes, right?
Right, and that's because that's what the legislature allowed as where you could forgive them not meeting all the requirements because of the pandemic. I think they're making the assumption that by 2023 we're going to be out of that situation, and by that time, hopefully they won't even need it. And they're kind of indicating that they probably don't think they're going to need it next year. But we were recommending that both years be approved, so if they did need it next year, we would have to come running back to you. But the hope is that they won't even need this next year; that they will need the further requirement.
Okay. How many of these enterprise situations do we have out there where we are forgiving property tax for a given amount of time?
There's very few right now. I'd say less than half a dozen.
Okay.
And they're the only ones at the present time who ran into this situation. Everyone else was not impacted by the COVID in that manner.
Well, I think we can all understand their disruption. What does that mean to us in tax revenue?
For the county, it's not a big hit because of our low tax rate.
Right.
I haven't actually looked at the numbers to tell. I don't know if Chris could speak to that at this point. I'm not sure.
Okay, I was just curious. You know, we get COVID relief for every other thing. Does the assessor, is there any avenue to recover those taxes for the enterprise relief because we're going to have to add a year to it or whatever?
Well,
probably not.
This is only giving them what they would have gotten had it not been for pandemic, had it not been for the unable to meet the employment. It's a property tax exemption that they would have got. And so
we're just waiving the requirement
for the employment
for
just
1 year.
Just for up to 2 years. But otherwise, if COVID hadn't hit, they would have been in good shape. They would have made their numbers, and they would have got their exemption. So this was just an intervening thing that happened that they had no control over.
Okay. Anything else, Chris? You have something to chime in on?
Well, I thought you might ask the question about the property tax savings here. It's about $2,445 this year.
This, you know, the way I'm seeing it, we granted them a 3-year. They're asking for a 1-year extension, and we're going to grant them 2. And so that's what I'm seeing. And I think they're a responsible player. So I think they're going to make their quota, and this is going to work out fine. So everybody else has been getting pandemic relief. This sounds like an easy way for us to give relief. And it's not going to cost us too much.
Any problem moving this to the WBS, commissioners? Okay. We'll move that to the WBS. That suit you, Wally?
Yes.
Okay. Item number 2. Proposed ordinance number 2021-002, an ordinance amending the county code, ordinance number 2018. Follow along if you can. 004-004 by amending Josephine County Code Title Number 19, Rural Land Development Code Chapter 19.19, violations, adding new sections to Chapter 19.19 and amending the title Chapter 19.19 to violations, administrative search warrant, citation authority, and fines. Augustus, walk us through that.
Okay, sure. So the last time we brought this to you, from the last time I brought this to you, we've made some pretty substantial changes. So I'm not sure if you're able to see here, but I sent you kind of an overview, but I'm not sure you got it. So looking at the ordinance, the first two things that I'd like to draw your attention are in 1919-010 and 1919-020. So 1919-010 is basically board findings that there are severe and pervasive issues relating to the unlawful sale, cultivation of unlawful cannabis in Josephine County, and that basically it's a detrimental impact. It constitutes a detrimental impact to the citizens' public health, safety, and welfare. And in 1919-010B, it establishes that the purpose of this section is to establish procedures that the county officials, primarily the planning department, are required to follow in order to obtain compliance for severe code violations by use of the legal system in Josephine County. So that includes citations, that includes lawsuits, that includes the means by which a property owner can get obtain voluntary compliance, obtaining and serving administrative search warrants, issuing citations, and initiating lawsuits if necessary. So hopefully that really outlines for people what the primary purpose of this set of code amendments is for. Okay, it's to go after unlawful production of cannabis. 1919-020 basically outlines that the county enforces code enforcement violations via a complaint-driven process. So it's just to establish that it's strictly complaint-driven and that the planning department doesn't devote resources to independently seek out violations of the code. And then it says, except as outlined in JCC 1919-080, which we'll talk about in a minute, Discovery of a code violation does not necessarily mean that legal action is going to be brought against you. It's just to say that if there's a code violation, there's always going to be a chance at any point in the process, really, to obtain voluntary compliance. And the last section of that, 1919.020c, basically states that the county will determine, based on resources, severity of the violation, when and how to pursue compliance for code enforcement violations. So those are the two biggest changes so far.
Questions from commissioners? I have a question.
Yes.
In anything, is there? I think one of the concerns is that, you know, we aren't going to be here watchdog at some point in time, 15 years down the road, and somebody comes in that has a whole other idea as to what this reads. Is there? I think this is answered a couple of days ago, but I just want to answer for the record. But there is an appeals process through the court system, correct?
That is correct.
If you think you've been dissed, or there for some reason planning or code enforcement is not following a letter of the law, you can appeal the fines or anything else to what, circuit courts?
The circuit court, yes. That's correct.
And I was thinking about maybe having like an appeals board, but if there is already something in place like the courts, I want it to stay there. That's where it would end up. Even if you went to an appeals board as a step, it's still going to go there anyway. So let's just send it to the courts if there's an issue there. Does that make sense?
Yes. And that's how this is. And that's how this is designed. It's,
okay.
Whether it's a citation or whether it's a lawsuit, it's all designed to go through the circuit court.
Okay, good, good. Any other questions, Herman? Nope.
No, not at this time. I'll probably have some more questions down the road, though.
Okay, sounds good. Mark Stevenson, you were there. You got any comments?
Well, I think the board is clear where I stand. I think the changes are very good. I think the focus on the illegal drug and cannabis is very important. And I know that Augustus is going to cover some other areas of this too. So.
Okay, so this should be moved to the WBS also?
I request that, but I just wanted to make sure that I go through the points, the things that have changed since the last time I talked with you. There's a couple more points, just for clarification. So,
that's good. Move along then.
All righty. So, as it pertains to the issuance of a citation, another thing that has been added is that open violations that existed on or before January 1st, of 2016 that do not involve unlawful cannabis activities or unlawful controlled substance activities won't be subject to the citation process and won't be subject to further legal action. So basically what that means is that if there's a structure, and I think this is actually specific to structures, if somebody has an unpermitted structure on their property that's, you know, that it's just been there, and it's been there since before January 1st, 2016, the county is not going to do anything to try to get compliance for something like that through the legal mechanism. That's just not something that's going to happen. So immediately after that, this is probably the most major change that I've made since I brought this back to you. In 1919.080, it outlines violations that are subject to immediate citation. So kind of as a background, generally, there's a process that's been outlined before a code enforcement infraction citation can be issued. That involves the planning department sending out a number of letters and trying to obtain voluntary compliance from a property owner before even thinking about sending it to legal for remedy. So this is generally something if we're talking about, you know, unpermitted structures using dwellings, people living in camps, tents, RVs that don't involve marijuana activity. What 1919-080 makes clear is that there are violations that are subject to immediate citation. And the violations that are subject to immediate citation are violations that involve code enforcement violations that are directly associated with unlawful cannabis activity, or code enforcement violations that are directly involved in any unlawful activity relating to controlled substances. The unlawful delivery, production, manufacture, any form of activity associated with or directly derived from a controlled substance, and the sale, cultivation, production, processing, wholesaling, retailing, research of cannabis without a license from the state. So this basically means that if planning, if there's a circumstance where the planning department has knowledge that there is an illicit marijuana grow somewhere and arranges for an inspection, and there's any illicit marijuana on the property, that means that the planning department can immediately issue a citation for any of those activities. Now, these are the only activities where an immediate citation can be issued. Every other code enforcement violation has to follow the noticing procedures that are set forth earlier in the ordinance, and they have to be followed perfectly to a T. Are there any other questions so far?
Commissioners? So far, I'm lying.
No, that's, yeah. I mean, we might not, you know, I don't know. I have to get down in the weeds a little more, but I, so far, so good. And keep moving on.
Okay. Yep. So far, I think you've addressed the concerns that I've had, so continue.
And so the last two changes that I made were the fines for the infraction citation and the fines upon conviction in civil litigation, okay? So the fines for an infraction citation, which is outlined in 1919-130, changes the fine schedule. So a fine of $500 per violation will be assessed for any code enforcement violation that's not involved with illegal cannabis or controlled substances. So, unpermitted structure. Say that somehow we get to the point where we are issuing a citation for unpermitted structures or people using multiple dwellings, multiple structures as dwellings. It's a $500 fine for each violation. So, a structure, two RVs, and people living in a tent would be a $2,000 violation, for example. A fine of $500 per day per violation for a code enforcement violation that is directly associated with either the illicit production of marijuana or the unlawful activity relating to controlled substances. So, that's $500 per day per violation. And then finally, a citation for unlawful production of marijuana will be $500 per day. The fines upon conviction. Yes.
All right, Commissioner.
Augustus, what is the definition of living in an RV?
The definition, you're living in your RV. You're doing your day-to-day activities, domestic living, in an RV. Cooking, cleaning, sleeping.
Is there a time limit on living in an RV? In other words, you know, if my mother-in-law and father-in-law come to visit, they want to stay in an RV for a month. Is there a problem with that?
I think that's a planning question, but I can look it up real quick. Don't remember off the top of my head.
Yes, I'd have to look that up also, but there are provisions in the code that allow a certain period of time for just that type of, you know, living experience for whoever. The illegal living in an RV would be using it as a dwelling unit full time on a piece of property or in conjunction with another living space on the property. That's both land use, it's building codes, it's a violation of all of those.
Seemed to me that when we were, a couple of years ago now, talking about construction sites that were getting vandalized and burglarized, we allowed the homeowner, while he's building his home, to hook up to his septic or whatever and well and live right on the property to protect his own investment. That still stands, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. We have that allowance in the code, and we encourage it, frankly, especially in today's atmosphere.
Well, let's make sure we have that definition nailed down going forward, please.
Then, are there any other questions about the fines for citation?
No, not a question. It's a comment. And I think this is what, gosh, I don't know how many, since the grow season really got underway, you know, please do something about these. I think this is going to hit the nail on the head. I like the $500 per violation per day. It's gonna, you know, that's going to get somebody's attention. Yes, Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, if I may comment on that, the ability for us to immediately cite them is key here because so many of these, they'll just drag it out until their harvest, and then they tear the greenhouses down and they say, ha-ha, no violation.
Right.
And it's created, it's known that they can do that, and it's created a mess in those neighborhoods. So that's a great point. On this ordinance.
But for the most part, like for instance, structures and things of that sort would go through the normal process of we'll work with you to get it corrected, we'll work with you to get it compliance and all of that. But then when it gets into the illicit drugs and illegal, that word is really important, illegal drug trafficking and activity, then we're coming after you and we're coming at you that afternoon. So I like it. I think that's what the folks, the people have been that I've talked to have been waiting for. Is let's get on with this thing. What are you doing to stop this mess? Because it's not going to get mad. I want all of this I want before the people leave the valley to go wherever they go, before they come back next year. I want them to know that the welcome mat may not stay welcome.
Well, not going back prior to January 1st, 2016, on these older structures that have been around for a long time. No problem with that.
Yeah, it's pointless to try to go after something like that. So, okay, anything else, Augustus?
And then for the final section is the fines upon conviction and civil litigation. So it's the same. It's supposed to be the same thing as the fines for the infraction citation, except everything is doubled. So you'd be looking at for a run-of-the-mill code enforcement violation that we had to initiate a lawsuit, perform service of process on the parties, get a court date, wait a couple, wait anywhere between 8 to 12 months to get into a courtroom, and then take it to trial and get a conviction and then get a judgment. For all of that, it's $1,000 per day. I'm sorry, $1,000 per violation for a code enforcement violation, dwelling multiple uncommitted structures, dwellings as structures as dwellings, illegal alterations, land alterations, diversion of streams, $1,000 per violation. And then it's a fine of $1,000 per violation per day for any code enforcement violation that's directly associated with either unlawful cannabis production or unlawful manufacture and delivery of a controlled substance, and then a fine of $1,000 per day for cultivation of marijuana, the illegal cultivation of marijuana, and unlawful delivery, production, or manufacture of a controlled substance.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none?
One question for Wally Hicks. Yep. Wally, is there the ability to make amendments to this as the process goes forward?
Yes, that is allowed, and charter addresses the specific process for amending between readings. Off the top of my head, it's basically we need to read them out in open session.
Okay. All right. No, I have no further questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Fowler, you had your hand up.
Just wondering if this proposed changes in this ordinance, is it appropriate to say where the monies from fines go? Is that, I didn't see that in here, and I was hoping we might cover it, but I don't know.
At least initially, I hadn't planned on putting it in this ordinance. The ordinance is meant to be a deterrent rather than a cash grab. I mean, the county isn't looking to try to raise money off of this or budget based off of this. But it'll ultimately be up to you where you want to see the money go.
I think that's a conversation we will have to have. That's a very good question, Derek, because that's a question I'm sure we'll get asked. But we'll have players. We'll have to just decide how many players are in the room. You've got code enforcement. You've got legal. You've got, obviously, sheriff's department. You know, it may be multifaceted right. Where it goes. So,
will we discuss that at a subsequent meeting? Because now it sounds like by default, this would go into the general fund, but I'm not sure.
I can't answer for it. Okay. Mr. Stevens.
So I spoke on this a few weeks back, and I believe the best place for it is general fund because we're not looking for a revenue source here. We don't know, have any idea at this time. And again, we're not looking to have a cash grab. So if it went into the general fund and we found in years to go that there's dollars in there where we can expand code enforcement or help the sheriff or what have you, that would be obviously a board call. And I think it would be best suited that way, in my opinion.
Okay, so if I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Something that came at a meeting with the Illinois Valley Watershed Council chair, and I think that those watershed councils and the restoration work that they do might be an integral part of some of the repairing these properties, especially the ones that come into county hands. We are hoping for voluntary compliance, so to speak, from an individual property owner, but if they do come into our possession, we want to make sure we're doing the right thing with the watershed, because I've seen a lot from the airplanes that they bulldoze whole mountainsides into valleys, and so I don't know what the watershed effect is, but I just want to make sure they're in the room eventually when we talk about where these funds go, because if they could get a small percentage, they could finance the repairs necessary to put these properties back in order. And so I just want to throw that in the mix, and we'll have this conversation later. Like we kind of do on fee schedules and stuff, we can have that outside of the ordinance discussion.
Okay, sounds good. Anything else for Augustus?
No. And by the way, I just want to say it looks really good. Thank you for responding to this is a tough one for our community to swallow, and so we wanted to make sure it made that narrow aim that we were really going for. So thank you for all of your hard work, Augustus and Mark Stevenson. Thank you both.
Yeah, I think it's very, I'd say language is very easy to understand. spells out everything. So great job, you guys. Okay, we want to move that to the WBS, Holly. What you talking about?
Yep, so I was going to chime in. So it's lined up for the first meeting on September 29th, Wednesday, September 29th, which will be concurrent with WBS. But unless the board says otherwise, then that's the next time we're going to see.
Okay, so that's the first reading on September 29th?
Yes.
Okay. That still gives us a window that, we'll have first reading and then second reading adoption within 2 weeks of that, and then it's adopted. And I just want the companies, as they're leaving here for the season to go home to wherever they go home to, that they understand that we've got something waiting at the door for them when they come back. I think that's imperative to me. So thank you very much. So we're on to item number 3, which is proposed ordinance number 2021-whatever. An ordinance amending the Josephine County Code, ordinance number 2018-004, by amending chapter 2.05, Board of Commissioners meeting. Wally, what's this mean to us?
Yes, okay, this is the rules ordinance. The charter requires the board may establish rules for its meetings, pursuant to ordinance, as opposed to board order, for example. And so that's what this format is in. It's fully formatted in a way that could be inserted into the Josephine County Code, and that's what you got in front of you today. We have talked about this on prior occasion briefly. I presented you with a copy of it, and rather than let the issue get too cold on the back burner, I thought I would just throw it on today's agenda. And if there's interest in just hitting a couple of the high points, I can do that. It's probably a good chance to do that. And then we'll basically take it from there. The idea is to capture current practices entirely, as best I possibly can identify. And so it's not to change anything, but it is important for this organization, from the feedback that we see, to have rules that describe how meetings are operated. And so that's what this plan is to achieve. And we can walk through it. This will take some minutes, but I'll try not to make it too flat. What I wanted to start with was right on the first page, under General Provisions A, Applicability. So this is where you get the universal nature of these rules. These rules apply to all meetings of the Board of County Commissioners and to meetings of all public bodies, including advisory boards and commissions. And so this is going to be the county's rule book for meetings, not just for the Board of Commissioners, but to all public bodies. And you see that key term throughout the rules, because this is going to be a broad effect. And then we can go into here. Now, if you go to page 2, there's F, attendance. And I know this has been something that's gotten discussion in the past. This one just goes and says, except during emergencies, as long as provided in official bylaws, members shall attend all meetings in entirety unless excused by the chair prior to or during the meetings. This is where I start to see the chair have a defined role in the meetings. And so that isn't something that we're doing presently, as far as I know. And it's something just to chew on. It doesn't have to be that way. But that is the issue of attendance is addressed in the meetings. And directly below that, we have commencement. Unless otherwise ordered by the chair, meeting shall commence precisely at the time described in the public meeting notice. And then we have the chair shall call a meeting to order immediately acknowledge the presence or absence of the other members. So we have attendance and timeliness both addressed there. And then H, the one directly below, the current practice, as best I can tell, and what I've certainly respected, is that any commissioner can place any item onto any meeting agenda. And we have any public body, including the commissioners, board of commissioners, the advisory boards, and commissions. And so that describes how things wind up on an agenda. Certainly something you can change. It doesn't have to be that way, but I think that's essentially the current practice that we have now. And then going down to J, violations. So we again see the role of the chair being invoked. And the chair or the majority of a present quorum has authority to order any person who violates these meeting rules to depart, or to be removed from the meeting for the remainder of the meeting, and they additionally suspend that person from participating in the next meeting of that public body. And then it says the Board of Commissioners may override the chair's decisions. And so that's a definitive consequence to what happens. We don't really have to work with at this particular moment in time, but that'll be something for the board to consider introducing into the rules. So we have now next actually more talks about weekly business sessions. And you notice that just like in the last ordinance, the new language has double underlines on it. And so present language is that a regular meeting of the Board of Commissioners shall take place at the Ambassador Auditorium, and it just stops there. But we know, and that's not how it works. We have the off-site meetings regularly, monthly, I think. And certainly, we have had them in the past, anyway. It's probably going to resume. And so I have ordered an alternate, real, or online location. So bringing in the present rules in line with the times. I thought that would be a good place to do that. So if you go to the next page, on page 3, the next change located in the document. Does anyone have the document in front of them? I guess I should have asked that first. You do? Okay. I do. Because I'm not going to make much sense if everyone doesn't have it in front. But I'll just keep going then. Okay. So then the next page, it says page 3. Also bringing in line with current practice, we have the next change. Where there will not be a quorum of commissioners present for business session, the board shall order cancellation of the business session. And, of course, that happens, officially happens at least once a year, when there isn't a quorum due to the AOC conference in November. And that's been a practice that's been employed, which I do think is so then we go through the actual meetings. I'm not going to hit every page of that, but you just see that we have various meetings. Describe the weekly business session has a description of the meeting, which we're very, very familiar to. And it describes also on the next page, on page 4, you've got consent calendar number 8, consent calendar. And so this would be a clarification of when things go on a consent calendar, and that's offered there. I won't read it, but it's intended just to capture current practice, because there's not, you might know, anything that we're writing down to guide that. But it's meant to be fluid and flexible, but at least a touch point to look to for how that works for the consent calendar for business sessions. And then we keep on going down through. We have workshops, special meetings. We identify on page 5 of the 11 various other meetings of the board and what those meetings are about. The administrative workshop, the general discussion, legal counsel update, and district meetings. When you meet as a district, I wanted to say that these are separate non-county meetings where the board forms the governing body of the district. You know, we know that, but this is a chance to actually put that into clear terms so that we know that you're not combining functions there when you even have concurrent meetings. And then it's actually in that district meeting, like it says the last line, district meetings may proceed or follow county meetings pursuant to the board's discretion. The district meetings may not be held during or as part of county meetings. Well, we all know that, but, you know, that's kind of neat to actually have it written down so that everybody else knows it too. Then we've got going down through, we've got further items. Non-routine sessions is the next section. Executive sessions. And so you get down to who's allowed to be there. Certainly you've got the approved representatives of the news media. That's on page 6. That's the paragraph D. And we have accredited representatives of the news media. We know about that term. And I got the definition for that out of the Attorney General's manual. Effectively, I almost went word for word on that, just to capture current practices. And then paragraph D2 is not a current practice, and so I got it out of the AG's manual. I tracked the language pretty close. It just says that during an executive session, the members discuss matters outside the meeting's proper scope. It is always proper, I think the AG's manual uses that exact term, it's always proper for media representatives to politely call the public body's attention to the fact that it is strayed from specified subject to subject to discuss in executive session. So that happens every now and then, and so, you know, it's in the rules. And like I said, I just got that out of the AG's manual, basically. Okay, moving on. And so moving on. Good. Now, if you go to page 7, this is really where the huge part of the ordinance is located. It's this paragraph titled Chair. And this would be a very defined role for the chair in a new era of sort of uniformity throughout the county and common understanding of all folks who are meeting, whether they're attending the meeting with members of the public body. And so for all the public bodies, board of commissioners and advisory boards, in that paragraph chair, it just says flat out the first meeting of the calendar year, that's when you designate the chair. And, you know, then it talks about what happens if there's no agreement that can be reached. And then it just says, this is stuff you can all change and adjust or delete or add to. But I just said the voting member would serve the longest continuous period of time until they become chair. So that question is addressed in a way that it isn't present. And then it talks about how to go over it. Okay, now what the chair does is defined, and I came up with 9 bullet points, add, subtract, whatever the case may be, but this seems to be about what the chairs are doing at this moment in Josephine County governance. Presiding over the meetings, and then preserving order, enforcing the meeting rules, and what have you. So that's something that, you know, just chew on that for a little while and see if that's how you want the chair to function in the Josephine County meeting, yeah, including the Board of Commissioners, but also the other ones. Then going on down, and I'm going to try to get through this so just in the way you talk. We're going on at the bottom of that page 7, we have public attendance and comment. Governments are allowed by the Constitution to regulate the time, place, and manner of speech. And there is presently an ordinance on the books. It's 92-27. And so I didn't want to tinker with that too much, but I did want to say all meetings of public bodies. So currently the ordinance that you do have for public comment says all meetings of the Board of Commissioners, which leaves it there. So we have now throughout the county all meetings of public bodies shall be open to the public to attend executive sessions. And then the new language says there's no requirement to include public comment in the meeting except the weekly business session or as otherwise required by law. And so that's a little bit different. So you're actually coming right out and saying that you are going to include public comment in the weekly business session, you know, which is not an earth-shaking declaration, you know, but it's not written down. And so if you wanted to get that written, then, you know, it's going to go into the rules. And the rules can be only amended by Board of Commissioners, by the way, or as otherwise defined in here. And then we have the conduct of attendees and participants. And we just described the current practice. I'm looking at page 8. Paragraph A, meetings shall at all times be orderly and respectful. When permitted to speak by the presiding officer, clarification language of how this works. You know, people just pop up and then some member of the commission says, yes, you. It's, we're going to have the chair of the presiding officer being the one who recognizes people. And then it says a change from each person, so each member or attendee should have 3 minutes. The presiding officer has that discretion. So then I've added a little bit down there. It says, the present language says the presiding officer may, it says adjourn the meeting or refuse to recognize me. And it says, anyone, present language says any member or attendee who is disorderly, abusive, or disruptive. I added profane, disrespectful, or inappropriately personal. And so a lot of us have seen or been to a lot of meetings. I think no one would go on like that. And I do believe that is within the constitutional allowance that you can regulate the manner of speech. Profane, disrespectful, and inappropriate personal would be an inappropriate manner of speaking that doesn't go with the content. People can be polite when they say things with which they think others are disagreeing. And then, so we just go on and go on with other kind of decorum types of rules. D on that one, again, the previous update with times, audible use of portable electronic devices prohibited during meetings. But then it says there is an exception if you want to allow it. But the audible use of portable electronic devices prohibited during meetings, any use of electronic equipment distracting just is prohibited. So that just means audible use of portable electronic devices, please turn your phone off. You know what I mean? Don't leave your phone on ring. not a new rule, but we put it down. But, and then any use of electronic equipment that distracts me just becomes prohibited. You know, and he got, you know, a really loud watch ticking in the background, and somebody said, throw him off, and, you know, please turn your watch off. And then we talk about the private recordings. We've been in this situation, and so this just addresses what happens. If someone, a member of a advisory board or whoever wants to make a private recording, and they got to first obtain approval from the majority of the board members. And then, as we know, meeting attendees will make private recordings, except during executive sessions. And then just going on the forum, so if you go to the next page, page 9.
Can I stop you on E?
Yes. Yes, yes.
After the chair approves a member or attendee to speak, the member may stand up or remain seated while speaking. We have to have a microphone for them so they're in the record. If they want to remain seated because of, you know, that possibility, you know, ADA, you can't, we really have to have that remote mic so that we can take it to them and they're, because they got to be on the record.
Yes. Okay, so we're getting something, how to just confirm that so long, they can remain seated, but they need to be audible to the record keeper.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, got it. We'll make a note. So that's exactly it. It's stuff like that we, you know, it's common sense, but to you, not necessarily to all who are going to want to eat that rights. So, let me just get that down. Okay, thank you. All right, moving on. Page 9. We're getting through it. All right, so now we have decisions. And this is what motions and votes are going to do and how that plays out. And it says, following our current practice, there's a motion, there's a second, there's a discussion, and then it talks about how the discussion proceeds. It says members who wish to participate in the discussion should make an invitation to the chair and then wait to be called on by the chair. And that's certainly the practice of the board here, especially of late. And so if you want to make sure that's clearly stated in the rules, then there's a chance to do so. And then it talks about if you want to withdraw the motion, what that looks like. And it talks on an F at the bottom of page 9, it talks about tabling the manner, what that means. And we had some ambiguity in the past about what it is to table something, and so we just go ahead and say that any matter may be tabled indefinitely following a motion, a second, and a vote. When tabled matters remain undecided and can be added to an agenda on a future occasion for some individuals. So that's what tabling a matter is. And then it just talks about how to do the vote. So I think we hit the main points there. And so I wanted to just put that in front of you. There's been interest expressed a couple times to try and get something like this there, kind of get something like this out there. So,
Polly, is there any opportunity or requirement for after a motion, a second, call for the questions, that you open it up to public comment?
No. And that would go back to section 2.05060, and that says there's. What's written down here certainly changes. There's no requirement to include public comment in any meeting except the weekly business session, which is otherwise required. So land use, of course, hearings, that sort of thing, you are going to need to require public comment. But if you leave it as drafted, then there's no requirement to include public comment.
Okay. There's no requirement, but is there, can the chair say I'll open it up to the public?
I think so. Well,
I mean, it's opening a can of worms, but I just wonder if the opportunity is there. Chair says, you know, I got a lot of controversy on this thing, and I want to open it up to the public.
Page 8, actually, yes, directly below the section I just read on page 8, it says conduct of attendees and participants. Meetings shall at all times be orderly and respectful. When permitted to speak by the presiding officer, each member or attendee may be given 3 minutes to speak or such longer or such other time as may be allowed by the presiding officer. So that does put the discretion at the presiding officer.
I think that option should be used very, very sparingly. You know, I just didn't know what the road rules were that, you know, somebody said, well, I want to really talk about that. And you say, you know, I know you're getting ready to say yes, and go from there. I just didn't know. So thank you for clarification.
Certainly. And, okay, well, I can make that change, and I'll send it out to the managers and see if they have additional changes, and then keep the process moving forward.
Mr. Fowler, how'd you handle it?
I want to say thanks, first of all. This great document, I think, will really help future commissioners and the public understand why we do the things we do. I love having a policy. We can always change it. But I love having a document to argue about instead of arguing about someone's personality. And so I do appreciate it. I wonder if you want to go back to 205040 on page 6.
Okay.
Meetings by telephone or electronic communication. Didn't Oregon legislature pass a law that we have to have the public have access to meetings? And so they have to grow a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Accommodate that language.
Yeah, great observation. You're right. You're right. So I'm going to have to revisit that bill to make sure.
Other than that, I really like the way this is written and the way it codifies what we've actually been doing.
I think one of the things that I want to add, and I'm going to write it down on here so that I can put on mic, because I'm probably the world's worst at it. I think it's very important that we call roll of the commissioners that are there at the time the meeting opens. And if, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, we'll get here just a little bit late or whatever, and you say, you know, Commissioner Fowler's here, Commissioner Bertrand is here, Commissioner Young is not here, we're going to start the meeting to remain on time. If I come in 10 minutes late, says, let the record show that Commissioner Young has come into the meeting. And that way we'll have a time together. That's pretty important. You know, we had an instance here a number of years ago where attendance was a real issue. And I don't know if we had any documentation to back that up, truthfully. And this way it would be at the beginning of every meeting, you would say, you know, present are all three commissioners and away you go. You know, or Commissioner Bertrager will be joining us in just a little bit of time. You know, and so we go from there. I think that's something I think just for record keeping, that would be very important.
Sure. So what we've got presently on page 2 is in the commencement section. It says, the chair shall call the meeting to order on time and immediately acknowledge the presence or absence of the other members.
Okay.
All right. And then I can add to that, late arrivals shall be acknowledged by the chair when the member arrives.
Okay, perfect. You got it in there. Good enough. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions for Wally on this subject? Okay, that's item number 3. Thank you, Wally. What do you want to do with this? Do you want this to...
I'll send it out to the managers, get their feedback, and if it's significant, I'll bring it back. But otherwise, okay. I guess I'll set it for a read.
Sounds good. Item number 4, Oregon OSHA complaint number 20945-6644. I hope that's not the number of complaints they have out there, and there's a 643 and a 642. Certainly could be. I'm dated September 10, 2021. Wally and JJ are both on board for a little briefing on this.
Our inside information has said that...
First, I need to ask a question. I'm inside a public building right now. Do I have to have my mask down during this meeting?
I believe in an enclosed office, you do not.
You believe that if Sean Hall were watching this and decided to get squirrely, could he call and say, I just watched a whole meeting where Councilor Wally Hicks, HR Director J.J. Schofield, and Dan DeYoung were all in a public building with their masks on?
So I have two answers to that. One, the mandate allows for the ability to take the mask off if the activity you're doing is unreasonable, for example, speaking, and that's specifically spelled out in the code. And a meeting that you're required to speak is a good example where you don't need a mask. And then there's been a number of regulations where it defines what a public workspace is.
You're going to pay the fine on that, JJ?
What's that?
You're going to pay the fine on that?
There won't be a fine on that. And then a shared workspace is any indoor space that is not an enclosed office with a shut door. where there's more than one person. So that's the requirement. As it relates to how many complaints they've had, we hear they've had around 30,000 complaints, which is close to 10 years worth of complaints in about a 6-month period. Luckily, they're not all against the county, but we've had a few. So what's in front of you today is a complaint specifically about the Board of Commissioners' office. They didn't specify any individual person in the complaint. They just said the Board of County Commissioners' office is pretty short. It reads that Office of County Commissioners refused to wear masks in the buildings, offices, and meeting rooms, and take them off immediately after recorded meetings end. Masks are mandated by the state and OSHA. So that's what the official complaint is. It's fairly short. We've had some complaints that we've been able to answer without having to take it to the board, but this one, because it doesn't specifically address an individual staff member or commissioner, before we answered this response, we wanted to get your stance. You know, what are you doing, and you know, what's your plan for complying with OSHA rules, and we're here to answer any questions if you need some guidance.
Can the answer be that the Secretary of Pool will work from home?
Sure. I mean, if they are not in the public space, then that is a potential response, sure.
I mean, it basically crippled the Board of County Commissioners' office.
If that's what
you want it to get to that,
can't.
I don't want it to get to that, but I also don't want to pay some healthy fine. I don't want to pay $10,000 because we ignored.
For me, my response is that we do wear masks in our office. There are times when we are speaking or drinking or eating where we're not wearing a mask. But it is our intention and our policy that in our office we do wear masks unless you're in your office behind a closed door. And so this seems like a somebody caught something on a one-off where this is not a standard practice in our office. And so I think the letter should be framed as such.
Okay, I mean, that sounds very reasonable.
Chair, you got something to say?
Yes, Commissioner. Yes,
Since we're Zooming everything, can we ask the public to join us through Zoom instead of coming into our office? That gets cumbersome, and I think that we should just ask the public. We're all having to Zoom. Let them Zoom and not open that room to the public.
I'm going to have to review the list to confirm if that's all right. In terms of complying with public meetings. So I'll get back to you.
Okay.
Let's look at that. I have a question also.
The problem.
Go ahead, Herbert.
The reason I'm saying that is we have no control over the public wearing masks or not wearing masks. So it just gets really complicated. And so until we're out of this crazy COVID era and we're all having to Zoom, is it possible to ask for the public to join us by Zoom also, just like the legislature does? The legislature did the same thing, Wally.
Yeah. Okay, let me get brushed up on what the particulars are for that issue.
I can't answer the question about the Zoom, but I can answer the question about our responsibility for the public. OSHA has put out some guidance on how they're going to enforce the rules, and they've made it clear that our obligation is to have signage up. Our obligation is to have employees and volunteers be masked up. And we have to do our best effort to with the public, but we are not required to enforce the rule with the public, because it's pretty hard to do that, frankly. So as long as we have signs up and we have our employees masked up and we don't actively undermine the signs, then we're in compliance.
I wanted to ask you this one. Which branch of the government did this come through? Did this come to the judicial side? No. If it comes through the executive side, because the executive has limited powers, the executive branch has limited powers also, and it did come through the legislative side. I don't know where I went through any, all of those three. I don't know the validity of it to begin with. There's a possibility we're just following because somebody said so, and we're all afraid that we're going to get it. But is that, you know, somebody asked that question to me the other day, and I asked the question, and the person told me, nope, there is all three of those, and that none of the mandates come through all three, any of those three.
Where?
To the county. So we, as county commissioners, are ordered by somebody, not the judicial, not the executive, not the legislative, to do something, but really can they? Do they have the authority to order us to do anything as county commissioners? And then find us if we don't. That's the question I have.
They're asking if they ultimately have the authority to find the county OSHA as the authority. But if they do, because the county is an employer.
Is it miserable care?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? So you're going to craft, I like Darren's very, very simple approach to the response, and then we'll go from there.
So just so that I'm transparent, let me know if what I'm saying is correct. My intention is to craft a response that we work hard to stay in compliance. We're not always 100%, but we aim to be compliant in having all of our staff wear masks. I can also include some communication that we have put out to all the departments from this office, you know, requesting that everyone is compliant and giving the rules. It would be helpful if that also came from the Board of Commissioners so that I can show an example of that type of communication in our response. So if I could have, we could craft something and give it to the chair, for example, and you can send that out as an example that the Board of Commissioners is showing the leadership in the compliance with the orders.
Questions, commissioners? Yes, Mr. Richard.
Wally, are the commissioners and yourself, you're elected, are we employees of the county?
Yes, Moses' perspective.
Need that definition. It's kind of like the legislature. Pardon me?
Oh, I didn't realize. I think he cut out. So, can you take that one from the top, actually, because I thought I heard your question, and then I guess I didn't.
Are the elective officials in Josephine County meet the definition as employees of the county? I mean, in the legislature, you're not an employee of the state. So, do we meet that definition?
I guess I assume so, but I guess I've never researched that point. So if you have a researched answer, I think I can get one point.
I can give a general answer to that. And the answer is, it depends on who's asking. So the definition of employee as it relates to employment law is different than the definition of employee as it relates to OSHA compliance. And it really comes down to, are you covered under workers' compensation? And because we're covered under workers' compensation, we're defined as an employee through workplace safety rules. As it relates to employment rules, elected officials are not classified as employees. So, for example, you as supervisors, it is against the law for you to discriminate against your employees under employment law. However, if you are discriminated against, that would be a civil rights issue, not an employment law issue, because you're not classified as an employee under employment regulations.
Get that, Urban?
I
see you scratching your head.
JJ, can you point to a statute? Or administrative rule under OSHA stating that an elected official is considered an employee?
I'm not trying to have to get it for you.
The board office.
Okay. Dig that up for me. I want to see the statute or administrative rule.
Is there anybody in there?
I think if you ring the bell, they'll come.
Well, I'm going to look at this, I think our staff here in the office, if they wish to work from home, then they have the option to work from home, JJ?
That's completely a management decision that the board can make, so they could, absolutely.
So if they say, I don't want to wear the mask, so I'm going to work from home, is there anything that we can do to say, no, you're going to come in and wear a mask?
You can make that management choice, absolutely. Like in my office, everyone in my office, I have them wear a mask because they're in the office. Yeah.
Okay, but can they work from home because of the mask mandate? If they don't want to wear a mask, is it perfectly legitimate for them to remain employed and work from home?
If that's the management choice you make, it's 100% legit. It's not a decision of the employee, it's a decision of the employer, and the Board of Commissioners, as the supervisor, can make that choice if you want to. There's nothing illegal about that.
All right. So at some point in time, commissioners, we are going to have that conversation as to what demands we're going to make of people that walk into our office. If somebody walks into our office without a mask, we can't make them put it on. And if the town crier walks in at that time and sees somebody without a mask on, we get busted again because we allowed somebody in the office who is just labeled a super spreader and go from there. This thing gets really dicey. It's gone on long enough to where it's really starting to get under people's skin. And it's no longer I've been wearing a mask all this time, and it doesn't seem to have done any good. And I have to wear a mask to kill this virus, but I've been doing so for 18 months, and it's worse now than it was back then. So I don't know what. I guess according to the courier, our role is to demand that everybody wear a mask, and
everybody get vaccinated.
And get vaccinated and so on and so forth. We've got a campaign going right now. In fact, it's in the works. Using the $538,000, we've got a pretty hearty campaign as far as the vaccination goes. Encouraging by way of letting people know how they can get vaccinated, where they get vaccinated, and so on and so forth. What the process is, what the procedure is, and also I think we're Public Health has asked for the mobile vaccination clinic because we have some places like Wolf Creek, maybe put it out there for 2 days, advertise it via mailer. I think mailer is probably the best way to reach the most people in Josephine County. It goes to every mailbox in Josephine County. I think that's very important. And we'll have a pretty good message, strong message on 3 or 4 mailers. So let's do some radio advertising. I have not gotten back with the written advertisement. I haven't heard from, I did hear from Kurt Hayden of the Speak Preview, and I've got to get him to figure out what his deal is. Also, ID News, I think, would reach a lot of people out about it. So those things are coming out, but I just didn't know, we're in our own office. I don't know how the mask mandate will be received. And I think you told me that it's up to us to lay those ground rules for the employees in our office.
Yeah, our obligation is if folks are in the office and they are in a shared workspace, they're required to wear a mask per those rules. Now, the public is not the same as it is to employees. This is an employee mandate.
Okay. Okay, questions from commissioners?
So, Mr. Chair, I think, sadly, that all of this has been weaponized and abused by different parties. That's very unfortunate because that sure in the heck does not help with the conversation of trying to get out of this COVID era. But it has been weaponized.
I have a tendency to agree with you. I think we're getting more this COVID. They keep saying don't politicize COVID, and yet they go right and politicize it right off the bat. I struggle with that. We're not supposed to politicize it. Please don't do it. And it's all politics from there on out. Commissioner Fowler, you had your hand in the air, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I took an oath to uphold the laws and the Constitution of Oregon, but I took no oath to help the governor do mandates. So I'm not going to help do mandates.
Good point. Something to think about. I did not swear to uphold the laws. I don't think Commissioner Benfinger swore to uphold the laws. Only the Constitution, and I don't see anything in the Constitution about the past. But, you know, we have an obligation to our public. You know, there's a lot of people that are really worried about COVID, and rightfully so. Not saying, I'm not trying to discount it. I've got two good friends of mine right now. One of them's on, I think they're both on ventilators, and one of them's in a, you know, an induced coma. That's not good. That's not a good sign. But, you know, so I think, you know, if you don't think we're taking it seriously, this thing hits just as close to home for us three commissioners as it does in your family also. You know, but we have a job to do here, and we're going to do the very best of our abilities to do that. So, you know, you can throw rocks at us. We get the stones. We get the emails every day. I got two of them yesterday that I read at a group I belong to. And it was amazing how they were almost all the same word, but they were just in different order. It was like, you know, they have a boilerplate of, well, let's see, you write letter A, and you write letter B, and so on and so forth. Neither one of them left a phone number. They did leave their name, and I could respond by email, and I probably will. But, you know, some of them are just, you know, I know that there is a very, very hearty network out there that's working overtime to keep us down there straight and narrow, and we're trying everything we can to do that. It may sound sometimes that we aren't serious about COVID, but I'm telling you, we're deadly serious about COVID. And all we want, all of us, like everybody needs to understand, we want to get out of this thing with as unscathed as possible and as soon as possible. Because it's starting to take, by virtue of the letters I'm seeing and the correspondence I'm seeing, there's an awful lot of hatred out there. I mean, it's gotten to the hate. There used to be just a discussion, and I disagreed, and now it's downright out now hate, and that's a dangerous place to be. That's a real dangerous place to be. Anything else on the OSHA complaint? I think we've got good direction from both of you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your input. You know, I think the letter you want to respond, if you could please draft that, just kind of run it by the board. You know, so we can, if there's anything that really jumps out at us three, we can certainly take a look at, okay? I want to respond. We have 5 days to respond, so what are we on that timeline?
We got this late last week, so actually, Steve, you would know this better with the date came in, but we only have 5 days, so we don't have much time left. So as it relates to getting board approval, I would ask that you authorize the chair to sign off on it, and that way, if we have time, we don't have to schedule another public meeting.
Do I hear a motion from the commissioners?
I'll just give direction to have the chair sign for all that, or have the last review from the chair. I don't think we really need a motion.
Okay.
Junior, do you think we need one, Molly?
Sounds good. I'm in favor of that also.
Yeah. I'll wrap that up and run it by you.
If you can get that to me, I'm stick around as long as I can. So if you've got it drawn up, I'll sign today, or I'll be in tomorrow morning also for WBS. Okay, thank you.
We'll have it by tomorrow.
Okay, let's do it tomorrow morning.
Let
us get into the executive session. Today is Tuesday, September 14, 2021. It is now 2:44 p.m. The Josephine County Board of Commissioners will now meet in executive session for the following agenda item. Executive session is 5A, Memorandum of Understanding between Oregon Cities and Counties regarding opioids litigation, National Prescription Opiate Litigation, Ohio Case Number 118-OP-45442-DAP-V-OR-Case Number 318-CV-520-MO-ORS-192.6602H. Approved representatives of the news media and design designated staff should be allowed to attend the executive session. All other members of the audience are asked to leave the room and the Zoom room. Approved representatives of the news media are specified directed not to report on or otherwise disclose any of the deliberations or anything said about these subjects during the executive session, except to state the general subject of the session as previously announced. No decision may be made in executive session. The end of executive session, we will return to open session and welcome the audience back into the room. The recorder, the staff, if you can make sure that we have the conference room open for public. Make sure that the monitor is not on there during...
Recording in progress.
Okay, we are back in session at 2:51 p.m. Coming out of executive session. I would entertain, I guess I would entertain a motion granting Councilor Hicks, representing Josephine County as our legal counsel, to sign the Memorandum of Understanding between cities and counties of Oregon regarding allocation of potential included settlement funds.
Yeah, I'll make that motion.
Have a second? I'll second that motion. Any further comments or questions?
Not at this time.
None for me. Please call the roll.
Commissioner Fowler?
Yes.
Commissioner Beerchiger?
He must be on another line.
Commissioner Dion?
Yes. Motion carries 2-0. So we'll get that put together for you. Under legal counsel, let me continue. Any subjects or matters from commissioners?
Not for me.
Okay. Commissioner Herman, absolutely. All right. I think he's there, but on another phone call. So, seeing nothing from me, we will be adjourned at 2:52. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your cooperation.
Recording stopped.